Turn in our Bibles back to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. Again, try to see if you can listen fast, I speak fast, and we can get through the chapter in a good time. The nature of some of these chapters, it's just hard to break them up. You're left kind of hanging in a way that isn't necessarily good. I mean, it's nice to build climax like our old elementary school teachers would do. Then they were reading a book, they'd end on a climax and leave us hanging as to what's going to happen, and come back tomorrow and we'll catch the rest of it. And that can be a little harder with some of these chapters. Okay, back it up here. So as we come here, we have the second vision of King Nebuchadnezzar here in chapter 4. We've already had his first one there in chapter 2, that image of gold, silver, bronze, iron, and feet of clay mixed with iron, the rock cut out with hands. And now we come to another one. And as I noted, as we've been going through this, and I think I've probably alluded to it in other times, I am of the belief that as we come to this chapter and come to the end of it, that we are dealing with a pagan king who knows the Lord now. He is not a Jewish convert, per se. There's no record of that, and the Babylonians may not want to have had that, had he been that, actually. So he wasn't a convert to Judaism, but he did come to, I believe, a saving knowledge of understanding that there is one God and one God alone. And he rules in the affairs of men. He is brought face to face with that in this chapter. And so this is, to me, an unusual chapter within Daniel itself. I mean, as we read Daniel, it seems unusual because of the nature of the visions that are given. But we come to this chapter, and it's unusual yet because while Daniel wrote it, most likely, most of it is Nebuchadnezzar's words. It's his recounting of this experience that he experienced. And so we hear it from his vantage point, if you will. And so that's why I say as we come to the end of the chapter, we see words that he uses in regards to God that are descriptive in other places of a Jew who knows God as being the one true God. And so as I mentioned, I think last week, I've come across some commentators that I agree with them or they agree with me, whatever you want to call it. We have both come to the conclusion that Nebuchadnezzar may very well have been a believer and we will see him in heaven, standing before the throne of God. But to let us get into this chapter and get the groundwork here, because this is not prophetic in the overall picture sense. It is prophetic because he's given a vision, but it's more of an immediate prophetic vision that's going to be fulfilled very quickly. So we'll see that as we get into this. But let's get into our statement here, this proclamation, verses 1 through 3, says, Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. That's kind of a remarkable beginning to the chapter, is it not? As we hear Nebuchadnezzar making these kinds of statements. Now, he has talked about the God of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, as we see back in the previous chapter, as he realizes that, their God is a powerful God. Their God is above any God that we have in our Babylonian polytheistic belief system. We don't have a God that could do that. But their God sure did. And so he's brought the one true God into his pantheon of gods, but he hasn't, you know, relegated to realize all those others aren't anything. But now again, as he's recounting these things, and it's a decree, as he notes, to all people within his empire, that he's letting everybody know, this is how this took place. This is what happened to me. And so we'll work our way through this. This is a change because, again, Daniel may very well have written it for, obviously, the book of Daniel. But we see the first person is Nebuchadnezzar. These are Nebuchadnezzar's words that Daniel is recording for us as he's made this proclamation to go out. And he's recounting this vision now in verses 4 through 18. We don't know within the reign of Nebuchadnezzar when this took place. Again, the Babylonian records don't record it. And when you look at the scheme of things, and rightfully so, because of the nature of what we're going to read about on really two levels. I mean, if Nebuchadnezzar has acknowledged that there is only one God, and it is the God of Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, then he's going against his Babylonian culture. Now, do the Babylonian historians, writers, want to put that in their history books? We had the great Nebuchadnezzar turn away from our belief system and adopted another one? No, they're not. Let's not put that in our history books. We don't want that there. So there's, again, good reasons for that on that regard. And so we don't know exactly. Most will hold that it's kind of later in his reign when this takes place. But again, it's all speculation because there is no extra biblical record of these kinds of events in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel doesn't note it. He doesn't say in the 10th year of Nebuchadnezzar, you know, this took place like we have seen in other parts of this to this point. There's no time stamp. So we really don't know. And so Nebuchadnezzar continues, verse 4, as he gives us this vision. It says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore made I a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. Then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. Now remember chapter 2, it was, I don't remember it, guys, but tell me the dream and the interpretation. Well, king, that's not how this works. You've got to tell us the dream, and then we can tell you the interpretation. But notice here, they're under normal circumstances. I'm going to tell you the dream. You tell me the interpretation. And he notes they still couldn't tell him the interpretation. They're left blank. I think God, in his wisdom and in his sovereign power and rule, said, you know what, guys? You're not saying anything. Mum's the word. I'm overruling this. I'm God. And you're not going to give any kind of interpretation. We continue. Verse 8. But at the last, Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And before him I told the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen, and the interpretation thereof. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the bowels thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher, and an holy one, came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, "Hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it, and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, forasmuch as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee." And so we have this vision, and we have, it's troubling him. I mean, again, any vision that's odd tends to trouble us, does it not? I mean, we have dreams, and odd ones can trouble us. And this is troubling him. I mean, here he sees this huge, vast tree that is taking care of everything, and then it's cut down, it's removed. He's told that there's a band put on it, and there's a change as you go into verse 15 to verse 16. This tree changes into a man, and I say changes. The nature of the vision changes, not necessarily that the tree turned into a man. But we've gone from looking at the tree to him then saying, "Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast heart be given unto him." And so within this vision, we have this image of the tree. It's been cut down, but now we're looking at a man in Nebuchadnezzar's vision, who is now given the heart of a beast and not a heart of a man. And seven times are going to pass over him until he's restored. And so we have this vision, which I would say would be troubling to me too. We don't look for meanings of visions. I would tell you typically if you have something really strange in your dreams, you might attribute it to the spicy pepperoni on the pizza you had the night before. Or maybe too much spices in whatever you had the night before. God's not trying to tell you something. God's given us everything he wants us to know right here. No more, no less. And we don't need to look to dreams and say, "God, are you trying to tell me something?" No. He's told us everything he wants us to know in this book. We need not go look anywhere else. And so we have this, and it's troubling him, and we have this imagery. And Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges that Daniel's the only one. I mean, one, he already knows. The underlings couldn't do anything. "Daniel, I know you can. Why?" Why would he make such a statement? Because he did it before. I mean, here he really did it before. He not only gave the interpretation, but he told me what the vision was when I couldn't remember what the vision was. And here I'm telling him what the vision is. And I know that he's able to do this. Why? Because of God who is in Daniel. Now, here I would say as we're reading this, he's telling us his pre-conversion stuff because he's noting you're of the holy gods. He's putting that plural. Are there holy gods? Plural? No, there's only one God. And so I say pre-conversion as he's writing about, this is my thoughts back here. This is before this prophetic vision that I've had takes place that changes me. But notice that he brings up the fact that God is in the lives of men. He sets up people and he takes them down. And God indeed does. I think this is a verse that we don't see too many deists in our day. Deism is kind of died out and is gone, but the deists typically believed and saw God as kind of a grandfatherly figure who, like the clock man, goes and he wound up the clock of the earth, created it, set it in motion, and said, "Have fun, creation. I'm not involved in you anymore. My hands are off." This verse, verse 17, reminds us in verse 18, no. God is active in the affairs of men. He didn't just wind up the clock of the world and let her go. No, he is active in the affairs of men. We see it recorded for us over and over and over again through the scriptures. His providential working to see his will accomplished. And it is still active in our day. And what a comfort to know as we look at the world around us, as we see the direction that it's taking, understanding this isn't taking God by accident. He's not sitting back in heaven rubbing his hands saying, "Oh no, what am I going to do?" I'm not making God the author of sin, but he's allowed these things because his ultimate plan is being played out. And we all will stand before him one day, but we have this going forward. And so let's find out, what is the meaning of all of this? This tree, this vast tree, this high tree, it's cut off. And a man's heart is changed, and this stays changed for 7 times. And then he's restored. What does all of this mean? Thank the Lord for Daniel and God's provisions here. So we have the interpretation, verses 19 through 27. Daniel is troubled by the meaning as God illuminates his mind to let him know, this is what this means. It says, "Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream is to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one coming down from heaven and saying, Hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till 7 times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which is come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as an oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility." Daniel is troubled because he knows what the meaning is. King, this is about you. And you're to understand that God rules in the affairs of men. God's going to take you from the kingship. And you're going to dwell like a beast. But your kingship is secure. Once you've come to that acknowledgement that the Most High rules, He's going to restore you to your kingship. And so we have this being played out for you. So Daniel is troubled because he understands that this dream would be of the king's enemies instead of the king himself. Because if you have an enemy, what does he want to have happen to the king? Let's remove him from the kingship. Let's get somebody else there. And so he brings this up. This is for your enemy. They would like to see this happen. But God, again, reminding us, God is in the affairs of men. And so we see this happening. And so he gives us this depiction of the tree being great and broad and fruitful. And the Babylonian kingdom was. Again, we noted that back at the beginning as we look at the empires. The Babylonian Empire at this point was vastly different than the Assyrian Empire, from the Egyptian Empire, and how they ruled, how they conducted themselves. And so we see a great change. I mean, it's not to say that, you know, everything was hunky-dory. It wasn't a democratic society. He was still the sovereign ruler. What Nebuchadnezzar said goes. If he didn't like you, you know, he could put you in the dungeon, he could take your head off, and no questions asked, there'd be no uprising because he did such things. But the nature of the kingdom had changed. Again, as we've seen, they were bringing in people that they had conquered and bringing them into the Chaldean culture to help rule those people. Bring them into our culture, and then we don't have to keep guards over them. And so we see this great change, and we look at the kingdom itself, and it's, you know, it is an amazing kingdom when we look at these things, and we're going to continue that here in a minute and get there. But we see what Daniel does as he comes to the end. We come to that verse 27, and he counsels him, and what does he say? Repent. Turn to God now. God may very well be, he doesn't use the word gracious, but I would say gracious to you. A lengthening of your tranquility. Turn to God. Now, I realize I may be pressing the matter a little bit, but when we think of our Old Testament, the minor prophets, did God send somebody to a pagan empire preaching them of judgment to come from God? He was a little reluctant. Jonah. What did those pagans do? They repented from the king down. They listened to that reluctant Jewish prophet who I really don't think was really bold and bombastic, except to say, yes, God's judgment's coming upon you. Yes, Lord. But also knowing in the back of his mind, God may be merciful. And I don't want that. I don't want to see these enemies die. God judge them. And we see them turning. And Daniel brings this up. Why? Because Jonah is a past prophet. Jonah is historical to Daniel. He knows what God can do in the lives of pagans. He's not of the mindset that we see later on, particularly, I'm a Jew, you're a Gentile, oh well, too bad. You're not part of the chosen people, that's too bad. So sad. Bye. They weren't the light to the Gentiles, as we see Isaiah reminding us that they should have been. That's part of the reason why Jonah didn't want to go. Why be a light to them? I want God's judgment to fall on them. They're wicked. Daniel is not of that mindset. Why? Because he does have historical significance. God does rule in the affairs of men. God does want the Gentiles to come to know him. And Daniel has been that light, and his three friends have been that light, particularly to Nebuchadnezzar in these last three chapters, showing them him, the one true God. And Daniel here is saying, Nebuchadnezzar, please, turn to God. He may well indeed spare you. God did spare the Ninevites. About 100 years, Nahum will go back and preach judgment against them. Only it will happen then. And the Babylonian Empire will take over the Assyrians. The judgment of God had come, and he used the Babylonians to do so. But in that interim, many turned to God, and God withheld. He was gracious, he was merciful, and he withheld his hand of judgment. Why? Because they turned to him. And Daniel is asking that again. Nebuchadnezzar, turn to God. Turn to God. Verse 28, we move on, we see the fulfillment, sadly, of this vision. And it came to pass upon, and it came upon the king, all this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon?" Now, I'm going to emphasize the personal pronouns here. "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" Me, me, me. Look at what I have done. And the Babylonian Empire, and Babylon the city in particular, was something that on a human level you could be proud of. Because Babylon was indeed great. I will give a little description of that city in Nebuchadnezzar's day. The city was protected by a system of great double walls, the inner line extending 12 miles around. The double walls were each 25 feet thick, with 40 feet between them, and a total of 360 towers 160 feet apart from each other. Through the center of the city for two-thirds of a mile extended a great 70-foot-wide stone-paved procession street, having walls decorated with enameled bricks, showing 120 lions, 575 dragons, and bulls arranged in alternate rows. André Perrault explains that the figure of each of the animals stood out against in uniform background of tinted blue with powdered lapis lazuli. The architecture and ornamentation were skillfully adapted to each other, and the animals were carved to scale. In other words, a full-size lion in this wall. And despite their multitude, the arrangements was orderly and harmonious. At the northern end of the procession street was the famous Ishtar Gate, 35 feet high, decorated with 557 animals in bright colors against a glazed blue background. The city was dominated by a seven-story ziggurat, a step pyramid, 288 feet high, known as the Tower of Babylon, not the Tower of Babel from back in Genesis. That's not there. This is a different Tower of Babylon. Nearly 60 million fired bricks were used to construct the huge tower, and on top of it stood the Temple of Marduk, containing a solid gold statue of Marduk, which weighed 52,000 pounds. At the north end of the city, near the Ishtar Gate, was Nebuchadnezzar's palace. His throne room was 171 by 56 feet, having a triple gateway and a richly decorated facade of glazed bricks, yellow columns whose superimposed Ionic capitals were crowned with palmettes, were linked to each other by a garland of lotus buds. At the northeast angle of the palace are the remains of vaults thought by Kilduwy to be supports for the terraced hanging gardens built by Nebuchadnezzar for Amytis, his Median wife, as a reminder of her homeland. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is one of the ancient wonders of the world, was built for his wife because she missed her home back in Media. And so he has this intricate hanging garden where there's a water pumping system that takes the water up to the top and garden and waters all of this. We don't have it. We only have kind of some mental pictures, if you will, from some of the descriptions that we can come up with. They still wonder how in the world it was watered. So as a reminder of a homeland, it was built upon stone arches and was equipped with a draw well and chain pump. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were counted as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And we have recreations of the Ishtar Gate and some of this in various museums around the world because they have found the remains of them and have put them up. It was truly an amazing city. And who built it? Nebuchadnezzar. And that's why he could be there in his palace and look out over this magnificent city and say, "Look what I've done." Notice verse 31. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." Nebuchadnezzar is going to live in the field like an animal. We've heard seven times here several times. There's a lot of conjectures. What does that mean? And some have thought, are we talking months? Are we talking years? I tend to follow the line of years. The reason being, when we go later in the book, where we find times being used, where did it go in my notes? Oh, there we go. In chapter 7, verse 25, we have time and times and the dividing of time. And we have believed that to be 3.5 years. A time, 1 year, times, plural, 2, and a dividing of time, 1/2 of 1. And we've taken that to mean 3.5 years, referring to the tribulation period. It's divided into 2 halves, and the 2 halves of 7 are 3.5. And so typical interpretation, typical understanding within the book, that's how that word is used. It's the same word that we find in chapter 7 as we do here. And since it's referring to years there, continuity would say we're talking 7 years here, not 7 months, but 7 years, not 7 days, but 7 years. And so I am of the belief that we're talking 7 years. It's going to take Nebuchadnezzar before he acknowledges to God. How long did it take Jonah to acknowledge God's sovereign hand in his life? 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly. It's going to take Nebuchadnezzar 7 years. So we still see, yes, he's been confronted with God, but there's still that paganness there until he comes to know the Most High rules in the earth. But that takes place. A year has gone by since he had that vision. And as he's standing there in his pride and in his humanity, thinking that he's the greatest thing, God says, nope, now's the day. It's starting. We continue, verse 33. In the same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen. And his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. Now, there's a lot that people will like to speculate on that. Did that actually happen? I'll leave that to God. I mean, yes, there are circumstances that kind of come up within history that speak of these kinds of things happening. I mean, can God make his hair like bird's feathers? Yes, he can. Can this just be an image of him being rather disheveled, like an animal living out to pasture? Yes. Since he no longer has the sense of a man, what about his fingernails? He's not going to clip them. And since he's not working like a man, they're not going to necessarily wear down by natural use. So they are going to grow. And so we have these things, I say, partly natural, partly supernatural. And I don't have a problem with either one. Because ultimately, God is the one that has allowed this and is having this go forth. Verse 34, and at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand. Nobody can stop his hand. Or say unto him, what doest thou? At the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. Again, these words of these last two verses are words that in the Old Testament framework, Jewish believers say of the one true God. And as we note in the progression from chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, we see this progression and God's providential working in Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar is introduced to Israel's God. Nebuchadnezzar has a vision. Nobody can tell him what it is. Nobody can tell him what it means until Daniel intervenes. And Daniel readily acknowledges, Nebuchadnezzar, it's not me, it's my God who gives this knowledge to me to tell you what the vision was and what the interpretation is. It's the God of the Jews. Chapter 3, with the three men and the burning fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar is still, who's that God that can deliver you out of my hand? There is none. Oh, yes, there is. And I acknowledge the God of the Jews. He's a high God. He's above all our gods. Yeah, he's something. But is he his God? No. And so he encounters and acknowledges Israel's God's superiority, but not to the exclusion of the other gods to this point. But now we come to this chapter and we see this acceptance and this acknowledging. He's the Most High God. There are no others. He is the Most High. And he rules not only in heaven, but he rules in the affairs of men. And guess what, world? He's able to abase you. He can bring you down off your pedestals. I know. He did it to me. What an acknowledgement. All because four Jewish young men in chapter 1, verse 8, purposed in their heart that they would not defile themselves with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. We will live for God regardless of what the world thinks or says. And when put to the test, Nebuchadnezzar, we'd rather burn than bow. Our God will deliver us. I don't think we would see Nebuchadnezzar making these statements if these four men had not stood and lived for their God in their day and shown him there is one true God, and I live and I serve him. Nothing man can do can change that. Whether we live or die matters not, but I will honor and live and serve God. May we learn that in our day. We can do this. These men did. To the threat of their lives. But it brought a man, a pagan king, to God. Our impact may do the same. Maybe not a king, but we may impact others around us as we stand and live for God as we should.